Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Kerry Olitsky, longtime expert on Jewish outreach and now the author of a series of wonderful children's books. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, we Jews celebrated Lag BaOmer, the mini-festival that breaks up the mostly serious period between Pesach and Shavuot, the holiday of freedom and the festival of covenant on the Jewish calendar. The counting of the Omer is a time when we count every day, remembering the ways that our ancestors brought a special offering daily as a form of preparation for Shavuos, the holiday in which we recall the great covenant at Mount Sinai that connected us to God in perpetuity. This period in Jewish tradition was observed by eliminating certain kinds of celebrations, including weddings, which were prohibited and still are for many Jews during the Omer period. According to tradition, on the day of Lag BaOmer, that is the 33rd day of this 7-week counting period, a plague among the students of a prominent rabbi ended, and that 33rd day, just shy of 5 weeks of counting, therefore became a day of celebration. In Israel, Lag BaOmer is traditionally celebrated with large bonfires and big outdoor celebrations, sometimes featuring games and contests. Archery used to be a part of these, maybe it still is. That has, however, mostly been replaced by a kind of general celebration. Roasting lamb and other meats, families gathering in the parks, picnics, and fun outdoors experiences at a very nice time of year in Israel. Or, in some places, Lag BaOmer is a mystical overnight gathering. The spiritual aspect of Lag BaOmer is tied to Mount Meron, burial place of the great mystical figure Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, creator of the Zohar, whose death might have occurred on Lag BaOmer, at least that's the tradition. It's customary among certain religious Jews for boys to have their very first haircut, often at the age of 3, on Lag BaOmer. When there are no COVID restrictions, the crowds that gather around Mount Meron on Lag BaOmer can be gigantic, especially for a country the size of Israel. People camping around the whole area, lighting giant bonfires, and singing mystical songs about Bar Yochai, putative author of the Zohar, greatest text of Jewish mysticism. Bar Yochai, nimshachta ashrecha, shemetza somecha verecha. Bar Yochai, nimshachta ashrecha, shemetza somecha verecha. In less mystical locations around the country, weddings take place on a wholesale level. Since in Israel, no weddings can be held during the Omer period except on Lag BaOmer, although some rabbis allow them on Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, and Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day, there is always a backlog of people who want to marry. In fact, I've been in a park in Jerusalem on Lag BaOmer and witnessed a series of brides and grooms getting hitched, one ceremony right after the other, all under the same chuppah. Really fun. I should note that Sephardic Jews often celebrate the 34th day of the Omer, that is, the day after, as their, Lad Ba'Omer, for complicated calendrical and mystical reasons. That means you might have not one, but 2 days of multiple outdoor weddings in the park. Unlike most Jewish holidays, which derive from the Torah or directly from events in Jewish history, the origins of Lag BaOmer as a holiday are unclear. The first mention of it is in the Machzor Vitri, an 11th century prayer book. Along with Simchat Torah, Lag BaOmer seems to be a medieval addition to the complex Jewish calendar. It's likely that the mystical parts of it kind of accrued along the way. Last year, because of COVID-19 restrictions, Lag BaOmer wasn't really celebrated in Israel as it normally is. But this year, with most of Israel vaccinated, we can expect pretty big Lag BaOmer celebrations to return, and I guess all those weddings, too. Here in America, Lag BaOmer hasn't caught on the same way other less central Jewish religious holidays like Hanukkah or Purim or even Simchat Torah have, but I've always had my own congregations do outdoor celebrations, including bonfires, as a fun way to finish the religious school year, to sing Israeli songs, and have something between an American picnic and an Israeli Lag BaOmer. In that spirit, and to play us in this morning, here's a, fairly ridiculous Lag BaOmer parody song from Avi Fryer.
Lag BaOmer brings a time for friends, a time to sing. It was Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's desire that we celebrate by light of fire. I went looking for a Lag BaOmer fire. I climbed Meron for my soul to be inspired. It yearns, yearns, yearns to feel the fire, Lag BaOmer fire. Yeah, I went looking for a Lag BaOmer fire. And Nicholsburg on 16th Ave took my neshama higher. Cause it yearns, yearns, yearns to feel the fire, Lag BaOmer fire. It's a day for archery, for upshernish and kiddushin. But there's no feeling that'll take me higher than to sing by Lag BaOmer's fire. So I went looking for a Lag BaOmer fire. Took the bus to Kiryas Yoel for my soul to be inspired. Cause it yearns, yearns, yearns to feel the fire, Lag BaOmer fire. Yeah, I went looking for a Lag BaOmer fire. A backyard in Hollywood took my neshama even higher. Cause it yearns, yearns, yearns to feel the fire, Lag BaOmer fire. Cause it yearns, yearns, yearns to feel the fire, Lag BaOmer fire, Lag BaOmer fire.
That was Avi Fryer's ridiculous Lag BaOmer fire. When we return on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Rabbi Kerry Olitsky, a friend of long standing who's been an expert on Jewish outreach for many years, the author of some 70 books, and a professor, has been writing quite wonderful children's books. Find out why when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson of the Catalina Foothills, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the Catalina Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, cultural Jewish programming, and even the opportunity to convert to Judaism. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone once again. Please join us in person Friday night and or Saturday morning. Email me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or join us any Friday night, every Friday night, in person or on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. The Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. We will continue to hold our services with full music in person and by virtual experience every week. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available on Zoom and in person. You can access those. Email us, BeitSimchaTucson.org, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson, or on our website, BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format as well. You can sign up for next year right now. Some of our students are live and some on Zoom, but everybody learns. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught on Zoom and in person, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook with Oneg Shabbats and Kiddushes nowadays, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEIT. BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at BeitSimchaTucson.org, the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest growing congregation in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Rabbi Kerry Olitsky, a multi-talented friend of long standing. I learned to say that instead of old friend at a certain point not too long ago. He has been a cutting-edge rabbi in the area of Jewish outreach, worked as or taught at Hebrew Union College for many years, was vice president of the Wexner Foundation, and the head of the Big Tent Judaism, director, executive director of Big Tent Judaism, which was also known as the Jewish Outreach Institute. He has started working in the area of Jewish children's books and done some really fascinating stuff. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Sam. Nice to be with you.
So what prompted you to write kids' books?
Well, over the course of my career, I've been privileged to write many books for adults. And I think probably the blessing of seven grandchildren motivated me to begin to look at children's books, particularly taking some of the more difficult, challenging issues that we confront, particularly in Jewish literature and in values-driven literature, and try to translate it for the young ear and young mind.
I want to thank you. Your new book is named after me and my fiance, Sam and Sophie. I assume we'll get some of the royalties on this?
Yes, if there are any, you'll have to buy a lot.
I know. That's kind of how it works with kids' books. It's a very different process, isn't it? Can you describe that a little bit?
It's a very different process because every time you write for children, you think of the word picture that you're describing in the narrative that you're creating. Not only because the word picture has to be obvious to the reader or the listener, but also to the illustrator, because while you give art direction to the illustrator, he or she is going to pick up the direction from the words that you're writing. We're also dealing with a much more limited number of words, usually somewhere between 400 and 800 words. If it's a younger child book, it's usually less. If it's a little older, you can go maybe push it into the 1,000 range. But you're trying to create a complete story in a very limited number of words.
Now, like 400 words, that's a rabbi clearing his throat, isn't it?
For sure.
In choosing the topics for children's books, how do you decide what you feel is the issue that needs to be addressed first?
It usually just comes to me. I have a book, for example, that is going to be coming out soon called El Cahibri, and which means the hummingbird in Spanish. And I was motivated to write it after my experience in volunteering with the tomato farm workers in Trua in Imolaki, Florida. And I decided that one way to share the story of the tomato farm workers, these migrant farm workers that I had experienced when I was there, was to be able to tell a story and share that with others. Another example of a book that I have coming out called The Whale of a Tale, which is essentially a question as to how do you determine when Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, is over on Saturday night in places like Alaska during the summer when the sun really never sets. And so it was after I traveled to Alaska during the summer, and I said to myself, this is a really interesting question that I knew the answer to, but I wondered how to share that answer with other people who might have the interest in the experience as well. So those are just two examples of how some of the story ideas emerge in terms of what I want to write about and what I want to share with others. And of course, the most important thing is that you have to have a publisher interested in the story. Even if it's a great topic, even if it's a great story, somebody has to want to publish it.
Always. We will talk much more with Rabbi Kerry Oletsky when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Jews of Afghanistan. Made a really good point last week about the fact that the Edot HaMizrach, the Mizrahi Jewish communities, the Eastern communities, are neither Sephardic or Ashkenazi, and they have their own ancient and rich traditions.
Right. Once I heard a very flippant Israeli tour guide in China respond to a non-Jew who asked the question, what's the difference between Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews? He said, oh, that's easy. Ashkenazim eat noodles, Sephardim eat rice.
Yeah. I know that guide, by the way, but never mind. Moving on.
Okay.
It's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, indeed. So in the course of the 20th century, the Jewish population swelled and decreased, but the dramatic decrease was in 1951, when probably 90% of the community left, and there were still maybe 5,000 Jews left.
They left for Israel primarily, I would think, but probably other places as well.
Right. As I said last week, they left for Israel mainly, but also Queens, New York, London, Marseille, and Paris. That probably accounts for 99% of them. Of the ones who stayed, they were a very tight-knit community, which sort of formed its own rules. Like, Muslim women back in the day wore white burqas. Jewish women wore blue ones when they went outside. And there were a lot of peculiar rules. But one of the things that I found so nice, when I visited Afghanistan as a teenager on a research grant from my university, and I spent a lot of time there. On the way, I stopped in Israel, where a professor from my university was doing a sabbatical year, and he and his wife had taken in two high school boys who were brothers from Kabul, Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And they introduced me to these brothers, and I said, hey, I'm going to Kabul. Can I bring something to your parents? They quickly wrote a letter. They insisted that I look up their parents. They said they'll invite you for Shabbat, et cetera, et cetera. So I went there, and it turns out their family name, which was Siman Tov, applies to about two-thirds of the Jews in all of Afghanistan. So this guy, who is and has been known for the last decade as the last Jew in Afghanistan, in quotation marks, is also a Siman Tov. And I'm sure that he's either a close relative or a distant relative, but part of the same extended family as the family with whom I once spent Shabbat. And there were two things really remarkable to me about my whole time in Afghanistan. And this was like 1970, so I was still a teenager. One thing was that Mr. Siman Tov took me to the synagogue with him every morning and every evening for daily minyans. And all the men in the Jewish community, and there weren't that many, all worked in the marketplace. They all had stalls selling jewelry or furs or leather, whatever, but they were all kind of merchants. And at the beginning of the day, they would wish each other a good, successful day, and they would reconvene at night for Mincha Maariv, and they would use the occasion to exchange news. Like, this was before the days of email or texts. They talked about the black market exchange rate, rumors from the palace, what was happening politically, whatever. And it was a sense of the synagogue as a gathering place to exchange news and maintain community ties, which I had never personally experienced anywhere else. It was the probably smallest and closest knit Jewish community I'd ever been in. The other amazing thing is at the end of this beautiful Shabbat in their home, I wandered off to go back to my hotel on Saturday night, and something impelled me to go to this big restaurant in the center of town. Not that I was hungry, but I was supposed to meet three friends who were on their junior year abroad at Hebrew University in Yerushalayim. And we had never really planned a day or a place to meet in Kabul. And Kabul was a big enough city that you didn't see every foreigner all the time. And I had no idea how we were going to meet. But as I left the home of the Siman Tov family, I was like pushed by some invisible force to go to this huge restaurant in the center of the city. And the closer I got to walking in there, the more certain I became that my friends would be there. And by the time I actually walked in, I wasn't surprised to see them. We met up. They said, how'd you know where we were? I said, you know, it's a Shabbos miracle.
It's a beshert. Only they wouldn't have said it that way in Afghanistan. Fascinating. And, you know, and I think when you describe how the synagogue was, it seems to me that must have been how synagogues were throughout history, where people came together, exchanged news of the world, prayed together, talked about their families, and then went home. And that happened morning and evening. And it was really very much the fabric of how synagogues started in the very first place, how they became what they are.
Right.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The location is a lumber camp in Alaska. Forestry companies hiring lumberjacks, and one burly guy after another comes up and is hired. Then a little old Jewish guy, barely 5 feet tall, comes up to the foreman seeking employment. You are a lumberjack? So tell me, where have you been working? Asks the foreman. I've been chopping down trees in the Sinai Forest, says the old Jewish guy. The Sinai Forest, says the foreman. Don't you mean the Sinai Desert? Sure, says the old guy. Now. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the Seder of Bahar B'chukotai, the doubled portion at the end of the book of Leviticus. In these final sections of the middle book of the Torah, there are interesting oddities and lessons, both at the commencement and the conclusion of each portion. Bahar begins with a statement God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, a seemingly unambiguous phrase. And at the end of the opening covenantal section of B'chukotai, the Torah reiterates that God gave all the regulations and laws contained here at Mount Sinai. Finally, B'chukotai concludes the book of Vayikra, telling us, these are the commandments God commanded Moses for the Israelites on Mount Sinai. All well and good. So these rules of holiness and personal conduct must have been commanded at Sinai. Yet, earlier in Leviticus, it makes it clear that God has given most of these commandments not at Mount Sinai itself at all, but in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, as the Israelite people wander around. In fact, the whole book of Leviticus is apparently given after we left Sinai and began our journey to the Promised Land. Clearly, as Bahar begins, the Israelites don't actually seem to still be at Sinai at all. What gives? The question troubles rabbinic commentators who believe that the Torah never wastes a phrase or makes a mistake. Their brilliant answer teaches us a profound truth about ourselves. You see, in the rabbinic understanding, Mount Sinai is not just a geographical location, a simple matter of a specific place. Wherever we learn and do mitzvot, whenever we complete ethical acts, do tzedakah, observe religious rituals with sanctity and meaning, study Torah, or work to perfect the world through tikkun olam, wherever and whenever we strive to make the world a holier, more Jewish place, well then, we are standing at Sinai. Almost literally, as committed Jews, we take Mount Sinai with us, bring God's very presence into the world. What a powerful message. As we conclude this book of Leviticus, so focused on creating holiness, we learn that we can make our own lives as holy as the very revelation at Mount Sinai simply by studying and living Torah each day. May we each remember to do so today. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Kerry Olitzky, explains how children's literature, including his new book, Sam and Sophie, teach Jewish values that everybody needs. Hear about it when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Israel, the eternal political gridlock seems to have reached a semi-logical conclusion. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu last week all but acknowledged he couldn't form a government with the mandate given him by President Reuven Rivlin. Then he tried to get the Knesset to pass a bill creating direct election of the prime minister, a concept that has been tried already in Israel and wasn't successful. Netanyahu's hold on power has never appeared to be more tenuous. But of course, if the opposition is given the mandate this week by Rivlin, it also appears unlikely to be able to put together a majority government. To say that Israel is ensnared in governmental quicksand is a minor understatement. There have been four national Israeli elections in the past 2 years. We can almost certainly now expect a fifth election, maybe this summer. The main challenge to Netanyahu forming a government these days is simply Bibi Netanyahu himself. Over his 10 years in office as prime minister, this time around, that is, he was also prime minister kind of briefly once before, he has alienated many of the other political leaders in Israel, including former right-wing allies like Naftali Bennett and Avigdor Lieberman. His efforts to form this government have ranged from appealing to the Arab List to trying to get the anti-Arab Zionist Party on board instead. Good luck. There's a famous phrase in the book of Amos in which Amos says, Lo Navi velo ben Navi. I'm not a prophet, nor am I the son of a prophet. Amos, of course, was a prophet. Well, Lo Navi velo ben Navi, I'm not the prophet or the son of a prophet, but I did predict that the last Israeli government would fail in 6 to 7 months. It did. And another election would lead to more of the same gridlock. I hereby predict we will see yet another Israeli election shortly. The only difference will be that this time Netanyahu finally will have to relinquish the prime ministership. Along with the end of the COVID lockdowns, I believe the Israeli electorate will have had enough of this eternal stalemate. Bibi has proven to be an enduring political magician, but I think this time his time really is coming to an end. Or will fairly soon. You know, probably. Also in Israel, an unusual community in the Negev is struggling with status issues. 45 members of the Black Hebrew Israelite community recently received letters from the Misrad HaPnim, the Israeli Interior Ministry, ordering them to leave the country within 60 days after they sought to regularize their residency status in Israel. Many of them have lived in Israel without any legal status for over 20 years, including people born in Israel. Dozens of other members of the Black Hebrew Israelite community have submitted similar requests that are still being examined by the ministry, but given that all of the statusless community members have similar characteristics, they aren't expecting the decision on their applications to be different. I was born here, raised here, educated here, and I don't know any other place in the world, said Yelital Herkles, 22 years old, whose parents are also without status. This is my home. Why should I have to leave my home? The African Hebrew Israelites of Jerusalem, as they are also known, are a spiritual community of African Americans and their Israeli-born offspring, who identify as descendants of the ancient tribe of Judah. They view Israel as their ancestral homeland. There are, well, there's a debate about this, but somewhere between 2,500 and 3,500 members. They comprise the largest organized African American expat community in the world. According to the Interior Ministry's Population and Immigration Authority, the community, often referred to as the Black Hebrews, are lived primarily in Dimona, although there are small communities in Yerucham, Mitzpeh Ramon, Arad, Tel Aviv, and Tiberias. This community claims there are more people than that, maybe 5,000 or 6,000. They came together in the 1960s in Chicago, subscribing to a theology promulgated by a guy named Ben Carter, a Black Baptist who changed his name to Ben Ami Ben Yisrael. While they started settling in Israel in the late 60s, it was only during the late 90s that Israel began granting them residency status. Ironically, under the same interior minister, Aryeh Deri, who is now apparently authorizing them to be deported. Way back in the 90s, the community gave state authorities a list of all community members. Those who had been in Israel at least a decade got a work permit, which then became temporary residency and then permanent residency, and some of them were even granted citizenship. In 2003, the remainder of the existing community was granted permanent residency. Those who served in the IDF could also obtain citizenship for themselves and their families without giving up their U.S. citizenship. Today, this interesting community is comprised of Israeli citizens, residents, and those with no status. Those are the people who were not on the list submitted to the state in the end of the 1990s and their children. People coordinating efforts to get the people officially recognized said there are perhaps 100 or so African Hebrew Israelites without status, when the state's immigration agency says it's just a few dozen. Rafael says that 4 years ago he submitted to the Interior Ministry a list of community members without legal status after he appealed to the agency on their behalf. Years passed, they didn't do anything until I approached them again last year and they asked me to resubmit the list. That sounds like Israeli bureaucracy. The Population and Immigration Authority then said that community members in Dimona received permanent residency status for humanitarian reasons 17 years ago by a decision of the then Interior Ministry, but not in the framework of any particular law. Well, the Interior Minister then is the same guy as now. Anyway, when the decision was made and their status in Israel was regularized, a list was drawn up of community members and their leaders. Everybody on it became a permanent resident. Applications made years afterwards come up on a case-by-case basis. Anyone asked to leave has in practice been living in Israel illegally for many years. There is speculation that deportations were ordered because the Black Hebrew Israelites who serve in the IDF, the Israeli army, but are not Jewish, are Christians with a strong belief in Israel. Pushing back against the Interior Ministry is a group of young members of the community who have served in the IDF. As part of a new Facebook campaign aimed at gaining public sympathy in Israel for their cause, they have been posting photos of themselves in Israeli uniforms, carrying signs that say, "I too am from the Hebrew community." We will continue to follow how things play out. In Washington, D.C., the National Cathedral is honoring Elie Wiesel, Nobel Peace Laureate and Holocaust memoirist, with a bust. He is the first Jew to be honored. Well, or maybe not. I would say he is the first 20th century Jewish person, the cathedral's dean, Reverend Randy Hollerith, said. He may have been referring to Jesus and some of the apostles, as well as statues of Noah, Joab, Isaiah, and Jeremiah, which are on the cathedral's stained glass windows. Elie Wiesel's bust will join other luminaries on the human rights porch in the National Cathedral, visible as you enter the cathedral. Cathedral is known for its role during presidential inaugurations and other days of national importance. I should note Elie Wiesel was, of course, a past guest of Too Jewish. His memory continues to bring blessings. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish Rabbi Kerry Olitsky, who has long been one of the most innovative rabbis at work in American Judaism. After a career in the Congregational Rabbinate, taught at Hebrew Union College for many years, produced a number of adult books focused on spreading Jewish learning, headed the Jewish Outreach Institute, which became Big Ten Judaism, and also was, I should mention, a vice president of the Wexner Foundation, and now has taken to writing some really charming and beautiful children's books. Outreach has really been close to your heart for a very long time. How do writing kids' books, how does that fit into that overall portfolio of yours?
I would answer it in two ways. First of all, I grew up in a small town, small Jewish community in Florida, and I was always conscious about the inability to access, especially that time, access Jewish thought, Jewish ideas, and the like. Yes, there was a synagogue in town that we were affiliated with, but it was still a rather modest endeavor in terms of the experience of where I live now in the greater New York area. I think that what has always intrigued me is the fact that even though we talk about the Jewish community as if it's the majority of Jews, it's always been the minority of Jews. And right now, at best, only 30% of the Jewish community is affiliated with an institution and the like. And so I have always been interested in reaching people who are beyond the parameters of, or I should say the perimeter of, the organized Jewish community, because that's where the real Jewish community, its majority, is. And I've always wanted to translate my work in such a way that it could be accessible to different segments of people. In this particular case, I wanted to, and I continue to want to, reach out to families, particularly those with young children, who are historically not affiliated with synagogues anyhow or other Jewish communal institutions, and provide them access points to what I consider to be the rich treasury of Judaism. I think, secondly, I would offer that Judaism and Jewish thought has entered the marketplace of ideas. And so that means that there are many people who may want to access Jewish ideas, Jewish thought and the like. They may not be Jewish. They may have no intention of engaging the organized Jewish community or converting to Judaism. But I wanted to provide a way that they could access in easy ways. And certainly children's literature is one of those easy ways. And we know from experience that particularly uneducated adults, often people who are new to the Jewish community, will access Judaism through their children and often at holiday time as well. So that's the other reason that I chose to go in this direction.
When you write one of your kids' books, usually, as I understand it, the publisher picks the illustrator, sometimes picks the title. Do you actually beat the illustrator?
It's interesting that with the global economy, or as Friedman once said, a flat world, yeah. With that change, it's often that illustrators are being engaged from all over the world. Not only do I not often get a chance to meet or communicate with them, but some of them don't even speak English, and certainly not as their first language. So it makes it challenging. But you're right that the majority of children's book publishers prefer that they choose the illustrator. But in some cases, I've had the opportunity to recommend an illustrator who was chosen, and in some cases, I've even been the person working with the illustrator. I have a new children's book coming out called The Candyman Mystery, and it's by a new imprint called Corona Yoke, which is an imprint of Endless Mountains Publishing. And we've just revealed the cover. It's printed and ready for distribution. The pub date is in September. But in this particular case, I recommended the artist. It is somebody whom I know and I'm well acquainted with. So we were able to work together, even though technically the illustrator was chosen by the publisher.
I want to ask a question in a different area. We talked a little bit about how children's books fit into outreach. From your perspective, what are the most important ways to engage Jews who aren't engaged? Are there any, you know, could you even come up with a list?
Of how to engage Jews in general?
Yeah, yeah, the ones who aren't engaged, which as you noted is the vast majority of the Jewish community in America.
Yeah, I think it's very simple. We built the American Jewish community, particularly after World War II, out of a sense of obligation. So people felt obligated to support communal institutions and the like. Now we've entered a period of time in which it's really about personal benefit. So for institutions to succeed, they have to be explicitly mission-driven, and that mission has to resonate with the people they're trying to reach. Secondly, we have to be explicit about that personal benefit and demonstrate why that has value for an individual. I'll give you an example. Nobody has to persuade me to take advantage of a fitness center, to exercise regularly, etc., because that knowledge is popularly known. It's going to, God willing, extend my life. I'm going to be healthier. It will keep disease down. All of those kinds of things which we know are part of the common knowledge about exercise. But we have to begin to talk about what is the advantage, what is the personal benefit for the individual, for the family, to engage Jewishly and engage in the Jewish community. It's not only the why be Jewish question, it's the why be Jewish in the context of this particular community. And I think that this is heightened by the increase in the number of intermarriages in North America and the world, because here families have a choice as to what to engage their family, or how to engage their family, how to raise their children. They can raise their children as Jews, they can raise their children in the other faith of the adult member of the family, or they can raise their children in American civil religion. So we have to demonstrate what's the value in doing so. And it can't be in the way that business has always been done in the organized Jewish community. The issues of Israel's survival, the issues of the Holocaust, however indispensable, world-changing, historical events they are, they can't be the primary driving factors in the American Jewish narrative any longer.
So, in creating children's books that are kind of open, right? I mean, they're based in values. Are they based specifically in Jewish values, do you feel?
They're always based in Jewish values. In some cases, the Jewish values are explicit, and in some cases, they are implicit. So you mentioned Sam and Sophie, which is...
By the way, again, just a great name for a book. We're getting married in June. I appreciate your tribute. Thank you so much.
Of course. You know what you should do? You should buy a whole set of them and give out as favors, because people will think that the book was written
just for that occasion. That's a great idea. If you could ship them to Kauai, where we're getting married, I think we have a deal.
We can ship them anywhere. There's a very interesting distribution company called the Book Depository, and they ship worldwide for free. Perfect. And the reason why this was an important discovery of mine is two of my books, one is immediately coming out and one will be coming out next year, and they're both stories about a Muslim kid and a Jewish kid. They're both being published by two different publishers in Great Britain. And the normal route, whether it's Amazon or any other local distributor, charges as much to send the book as it does to pay for the book. The Book Depository is a vehicle which allows these books to be purchased and distributed any place in the world for free. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I've always checked all of those things out before. In any case, Sam and Sophie is a story that is implicitly Jewish because it deals with the birth of a child and the Jewish tradition of planting a tree in honor of the child, which will be eventually cut down, according to Jewish tradition, and used for the material of a chuppah, a wedding canopy, at one's wedding.
I always love that tradition, by the way. It really is.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And we planted evergreens on our property consistent with that tradition, God willing, so when our grandchildren get married, they will be able to use the wood from those trees as well. And whenever they come to visit, they take a look at their tree. So it's not just a Jewish tradition, it bears other values as well. But in the case of Sam and Sophie, it's not explicit in the narrative, it is explicit in the notes. But what's really interesting is this is published by a publisher called Higher Ground. And it's essentially a publisher that deals with Christian and values-driven material. So it's particularly important to me that my children's books in particular are not simply published by Jewish publishers that are going to make inroads in the organized and the unaffiliated community, but also in the broader community as well.
So, Kerry, I have to ask you, you've published something like 75 books. Maybe it's up to 80 now?
Yeah, I decided to stop counting at 75.
That's not so bad. Do you have a favorite?
Yes. My favorite book is a little book called From Your Father's House, and it was published some years ago by the Jewish Publication Society. And it's essentially meditations on manhood, which has been used by numerous groups of men to explore their masculinity.
The creation of a book is sometimes described as a little bit like giving birth. You've done it so effortlessly, it always seemed to me. I remember once having a conversation with you in which you described how you literally wrote on the train going to Hebrew Union College to teach and back every day. It seems like it should be harder than it is. How do you make it so easy?
It's not easy at all. It's very hard. And our teacher, Dr. Jacob Rader Marcus of blessed memory, used to say that the greatest asset of a writer is the chair that he sits in. And I think that what he essentially meant is that there's a certain discipline to writing. In the same way that I doesn't every day, in the same way that I do other kinds of things regularly, exercise, etc., I make sure to write every day as part of the exercise. So that's one thing. The second thing is that I continue to struggle over the work, but the more you write, the easier it comes, and the connections are made, but it's still a very hard process, and every time a new book comes out, you're right, it is like the birth of a baby, and I think it was Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, who said that there's no end to the making of a book.
Yeah, the making of books, there is no end, right?
Yeah, so I think there is that. Frankly, today, the reason why that particular statement rings even truer is because the publisher and the author today are partners in the book process, much more so than before because of electronics, A, and because of social media, B. In other words, it used to be you would send a manuscript away and the publisher would manage everything about it. Copy editing, all of those kinds of things. Now, when the copy edits come back, generally, the author has to literally make those edits. And after the book is published, there has to be a guarantee on the part of the author to also help promote the book, sell the book, et cetera, because the author and the publisher are making investments. So things have changed drastically over the course of my career. And you're right, it was a quip, but it was true that since I spent a lot of time commuting, a lot of the writing that I did up until recently was on the train going back and forth to New York.
I want to thank Rabbi Kari Oleski for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people find out more about your new children's books and about you?
The best place to look is on my website, which is KariOleski.com, spelled correctly, KerryOleitzky.com. And you can also get most of these books through Amazon and other local booksellers. Sam and Sophie, as I mentioned, is published by Higher Ground Books and Media, and it's available right now, and I would encourage everybody to purchase it. And I thank you.
Kari, thank you so much. All the best.
Take care.
Bye-bye now. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Professor Idan Dershowitz, whose startling research into the origins of the Hebrew Bible have opened up the idea that there may have been an earlier version of Deuteronomy, and that scroll fragments of it, regarded as fakes back in the 19th century, actually might have been the real thing. Quite a story. Don't miss it next Sunday morning. Our playout this morning comes from the just-passed mini-festival of Lag BaOmer. Don't forget, you can join us in person at Congregation Beit Simcha this Friday night for services on Oneg Shabbat or Saturday morning. Just be sure to email me to confirm. rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and of peace.
Yeah.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.